I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, Pennsylvania courts rule that Independence Blue Cross must pay for in-school care for an autistic child. First, Philadelphia will be under a snow emergency as of 9 o'clock this evening. The city will ramp up operations with the clearing of snow emergency routes, and Vince Fennerty of the Parking Authority says cars there after 9 will be towed. The authority is offering $5 parking in its lots until the emergency is over. Meanwhile, SEPTA is suspending almost all service, including buses, trolleys, regional rail, and the Norristown high-speed line starting at 4 a.m. tomorrow. General Manager Jeff Knuppel says only the Broad Street and Market Frankfurt subway lines will run through the storm.
We hope to be able to restore much of our service early Sunday morning, but downed trees and road conditions will dictate which services we will be able to run.
Knuppel says the Monday commute depends on how well the cleanup and emergency repairs go on Sunday. For an up-to-date projection on how the storm will play out in our area, I'm joined by Adam Moyer, Senior Vice President of Analytics and Meteorology at Planalytics and co-founder of PhillyWeather.net. Adam, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Well, it's 6:07. What's the latest forecast?
All right. So for the city of Philadelphia, we're looking at somewhere between 14 and 22 inches of snow to fall starting right around now and lasting through around 9 o'clock tomorrow night until maybe midnight tomorrow night. That's a pretty big range, but it could even be further than that. There's been a couple pieces of data that's come in this afternoon that have been indicating that we could see as much as 30 inches of snow in the Philly metro area. But right now, I think the best guess is between 14 and 22 inches.
And will that snow more or less be sustained, or will we get any breaks over that interval?
Good question. So it looks like there's going to be a first wave that comes through in the overnight hours and puts down 6 to 10 inches of snow by daybreak tomorrow. And then we get a little bit of a lull around breakfast time, 7 to 10 o'clock in the morning. And then as we head towards lunchtime, a second wave comes in and drops another heavy bout of snow as we head into the afternoon hours.
Heavy bout of snow, but is it light or heavy snow?
Good question. So it seems like the first batch will probably be lighter, fluffier snow. The second batch later on in the afternoon will be a heavier snow, more difficult to shovel.
Do we have to anticipate any ice in our region, as we're hearing of ice storms further south?
Yeah, so Charlotte and Raleigh are getting hammered right now with an ice storm down there. I think for our area, we might see some sleet mixing in, particularly as you head towards the Jersey Shore. But for the immediate Philly metro area, I don't think we'll have much to worry about in terms of ice.
Now let's factor in the potential for storm surge.
Oh, sure. Down in the Atlantic County and Cape May County, as well as the Delaware beaches, they're looking at some historic coastal flooding that might rival the coastal flooding we saw with Hurricane Sandy. We're looking at, 20, 25, 30-foot wave heights, surge moving several hundreds of feet inland. It's a really underplayed part of the story, I think.
Will these high winds persist even after the snow clears out?
Yeah, well, so Sunday's going to be a windy day across the region. I don't think we won't be seeing like 50 or 60 mile an hour winds like we will on Saturday, but we'll still be seeing 20, 25, 30 mile an hour winds as the storm exits on Sunday before everything calms down on Monday.
Once again, what's the range of snow accumulation, and does it vary much between our southerner listeners in Delaware and those perhaps closer to Princeton or north?
Sure. So Philly proper, we're looking at 14 to 22 inches is the most likely range. High-end possibility, like the worst-case scenario, we're looking at 30 inches in the city. If you head further south toward like Wilmington and Dover, a little bit higher, maybe closer to 16 to 24 inches of snow. And further north up towards Allentown or Princeton, they're looking at a little bit less, maybe like 10 to 16 inches.
Adam, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Adam Moyer is Senior Vice President of Analytics and Meteorology at Planalytics. You can keep up with the latest on the storm at our website, newsworks.org. Last night's Philadelphia School Reform Commission meeting was full of drama and surprises. In the end, three more district schools were put on track to be converted to neighborhood-based charters. As WHYY's Kevin McCory reports, with one of the schools, the SRC went against the superintendent's wishes.
Philadelphia Superintendent William Height had recommended charter conversion for Cook Elementary in Logan and Huey Elementary in West Philadelphia. matching them respectively with charter operators Great Oaks and Global Leadership Academy. Height had originally also planned converting Wister Elementary in Germantown, but changed his mind after the district found evidence that the school was making progress.
We have seen some growth at Wister, and the acknowledgement of that growth then means that the school has moved out of a tier that then would normally require a most drastic intervention.
Even with that progress, only 3% of Wister students score proficient on state math tests, a point that infuriated many Wister parents who had become attached to the idea of a conversion.
My child deserves better. My child is in a failing school. The school been failing. This ain't the start. This ain't nothing new.
David Childs, a parent of a Wister first grader, sparred with the traditional public school advocates in the crowd who were happy that Height had chosen against turning the school over to Mastery Charter.
Y'all don't even live in my community. Y'all don't know what goes down with my kids. I see what goes on. Y'all don't be in our meetings. So don't talk about something that y'all don't know.
Novalette Jones's son is in pre-K at Wister. She praised Height for pushing to keep the school within district control.
I love the family that we have built at Wister, and I want to thank you for making that decision because you have took a lot of weight off of our back with the fight, but we are now going to fight for our school.
Ultimately, though, the pro-conversion outcry was enough to push some of the SRC members to overrule Height. At the end of the nearly five-hour meeting, Commissioner Sylvia Sims introduced a surprise resolution that put conversion back on the table.
Families are literally crying for alternatives, and they have shown us by their choices that they are not pleased with the way we are educating their children.
Commissioners Bill Green and Feather Houston joined Sims to undo Height's recommendation. The commissioners voted 4-1 to proceed with charter conversion at the other two schools. SRC Chair Marge Neff voted against all the conversions, saying the district cannot afford the extra costs involved.
We're still in a zero-sum game when it comes to funding, and I don't believe that we can continue to do that, so I'm voting no.
These votes are technically not the final word. Another vote will be taken in March. After the meeting, Superintendent Height said he had a suspicion that the SRC was going to disagree with him about Wister.
The SRC just felt the weight of the parents. This was a lot to deal with. I mean, this was a tough and emotional piece. And what they said was they're not approving a charter, but instead continuing the process.
In other business, the SRC approved a plan to create a new non-selective Science Leadership Academy middle school in University City. It also rejected a revised bid for a new charter school from a group with past ties to the Catholic Church. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCory.
In November, a Pennsylvania Superior Court ruled that Independence Blue Cross must cover in-school autism support care for a Philadelphia family's son. The insurer appealed for the ruling to be reheard, but just this week the court rejected that appeal. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Kiri A. Greenberg reports.
When Anthony Burke started kindergarten in 2009, his father worked nights as a Philadelphia police officer so he could be in the classroom all day as his son's assistant. Why? Because his family's health insurance wouldn't cover Anthony's assisted behavioral analysis, or ABA therapy, while he was in school. ABA therapy is a top recommendation for medical treatment of autism's effects and falls under Pennsylvania's Autism Insurance Act. In November, the Superior Court sided with the Burke family, demanding the insurer cover ABA therapy while kids are in school. And now Blue Cross has lost an appeal for the Superior Court to rehear the case. The Burks' lawyer, David Gates, from the Pennsylvania Health Law Project, says the next step is to work with providers to identify other kids who may be eligible for in-school services.
I would hope that the state would look into this and be sure that the other insurers are also covering services in school.
Lindsay Shea directs Pennsylvania's Autism Services Resource Program. She hopes this case will give families more options.
For a long time, it was well known that insurers would not pay for services in schools, providers kind of stopped trying.
Anthony is now 12, and his dad, John, says the family's lawsuit purposely does not include a price tag.
We never filed anything in court to be compensated for anything. All we want are the services to be provided by the insurance company like they're supposed to.
For WHYY News, I'm Carrie A. Greenberg.
Checking in on this evening's headlines, the Wolf administration is adding 5,300 children to a state kindergarten program for at-risk 3- and 4-year-olds, and nearly 1,000 to the Head Start Supplemental Assistance Program, combining schooling, health care, nutrition, and parental involvement. Democratic Governor Tom Wolf says today that the partial budget signed last month contained about a quarter of the funding he sought, and he hopes to add more as budget talks ensue. The nation's Housing and Urban Development Secretary says New Jersey lost out on millions of dollars of Superstorm Sandy aid, in part because its application was weaker than others. New Jersey is receiving only $15 million of the $326 million it requested. The money will help towns develop plans to address flood risks. New Jersey officials mainly wanted the cash for the Meadowlands region. HUD Secretary Julian Castro says state officials were warned their application was deficient compared to others, and New Jersey's aid pales compared to the $176 million awarded to New York City, $36 million given to New York State. Governor Chris Christie's administration and members of the state's congressional delegation are calling for an investigation. This is WHYY. Still ahead, some coastal New Jersey homeowners are not happy about dunes that the state wants to build on their land.
They are opposing the state's efforts here. They think they're unnecessary, and they think, quite frankly, that the public resources can be put to a better use by trying to provide protection in other ways that they are not already doing on their own dime.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
You might remember Roxanne Dawson as the half-human, half-Klingon lieutenant on Star Trek Voyager. These days, though, she is behind the camera.
Directing had always interested me. Even I started in the theater, and so I directed a bit in the theater, was a member of Circle Repertory in New York. And so stepping onto the other side of the camera was really not that different for me.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lights, camera, action. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. During the past century, audiences have come to know the composer through the radiance of his spirit. Yannick Nezet-Séguin leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in the Fourth Symphony, The Romantic of Anton Bruckner. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday and Friday at the Kimmel Center, Bruckner's Romantic Symphony with Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. As the storm zeroes in on our region, volunteer-run shelters in Bucks County are gearing up to get people who sleep outside in from the cold. WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports on this weekend's Code White.
On a recent frigid evening, volunteers with the group Advocates for the Homeless and Those in Need were signing in guests for a temporary shelter at Woodside Church in Yardley.
Did you come in by bus?
Yes. Greg Krockenberg and his service dog, Sarah, have come to the shelter a few times since the trailer he lived in burned down.
He had a trailer burned down. I lost my truck, and so I just stepped back.
When he's not at the shelter, Krockenberg says he sleeps in another truck he owns. The advocacy group runs Code Blue shelters in churches in Lower Bucks County when the mercury dips below 26 degrees. Volunteer Hillary Walp explains that when there's a big snowstorm, they declare a Code White and hunker down for longer.
We will bring our guests in on Friday night. They'll stay through the day, Saturday, stay over Saturday night, and when the roads are passable on Sunday, the buses will take them back.
And you might think staffing a shelter that's almost entirely run by volunteers for an entire weekend would be difficult. But that's just how it works, says Walp.
There's just certain volunteers that we just love to do it. And
you've been here before?
It's like our job. And, okay. You know, you've been here before. You got to be at your job in the snow, you go in the snow.
Advocates for the Homeless and Those in Need is one of three volunteer groups that provides the only temporary winter shelters in Bucks County. Montgomery County officials say they'll be opening their Code Blue shelters for the entire weekend as well. Laura Benshoff, WHYY News.
A group of homeowners in coastal Ocean County is fighting back against the use of eminent domain by the state of New Jersey. As WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, the conflict centers on construction of protective sand dunes.
New Jersey and the Army Corps of Engineers started building sand dunes along the coastline after the devastating floods of Superstorm Sandy 3 years ago. But not all beachfront homeowners are on board, and the state is moving to take parts of their land for dune construction through its power of eminent domain. Anthony Delapelle represents the 17 homeowners in Point Pleasant, Brick, and Manaloking who he says already have sand dunes for protection.
They are opposing the state's efforts here. They think they're unnecessary. And they think, quite frankly, that the public resources can be put to a better use by trying to provide protection in other ways that they are not already doing on their own dimes and at their own expense.
Beachfront homeowners in other parts of the state, including Margate near Atlantic City, have also challenged New Jersey on its use of eminent domain for beach protection projects. But many scientists agree that something has to be done to protect coastal towns from increasingly stronger storms.
Superstorm Sandy certainly showed that dunes were a very good first defense for flooding and storm surge coming in on the ocean side.
Lisa Auermuller is the watershed coordinator for the Rutgers Estuary and Research Center in Tuckerton. She helps policymakers understand the science behind coastal protection.
There is consensus that we need to look at those issues and those vulnerabilities, especially as flooding increases and gets exacerbated with factors like sea level rise. There is not consensus about exactly the right way to do it.
That could change this weekend with Winter Storm Jonas. The state climatologist says storm surge levels in South Jersey could be as bad as they were during Superstorm Sandy. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Now 10 days out from the Iowa caucuses, let's gauge public appetite for the current cadre of candidates with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, as an aggregate, are Americans more positive about this roster than they were in election cycles in the past?
Well, everything is relative. How is that? 66% is the number. That's the percent of Americans who say that there is a candidate running who would make a good president. Clearly, compared to 1992, it is up. Only 40% at this point, January of 1992, said there was a candidate running they thought would make a good president. Now, that's an important year. Now, that's when George Bush Sr. was running for re-election. Bill Clinton was running but did not yet have the nomination. And later that year, of course, Ross Perot entered as an independent, at some points was leading in the polls, and ended up getting 19% of the vote in that election that year. So clearly this is not 1992, where everyone's so disappointed in who's running that they're clamoring for an independent candidate. On the other hand, if we go back to January of 08, which was an open seat election where McCain ended up running against Obama. 84% said there was a candidate running who would make a good president. And back in January of 2002, we had 75% who said there was a candidate running. That was Bush, of course, against Vice President Gore. So it's a little lower than some elections, but clearly, again, much higher satisfaction with this group of people running than we saw back in 92.
Is the relative strength of support for the aggregate skewed by overwhelming support for a particular person, and Donald Trump comes to mind?
It certainly could be. We ask in the aggregate, is there any candidate running you think would be a good president? So if there's one out there that you really like, then you would answer that question yes.
Focusing on the Donald, what do Americans think would be, for example, the best thing about a Trump presidency?
Well, first I should say that well over 40% of Americans can't come up with anything that would be the best thing about a Trump presidency. If we look at Democrats, by the way, that's well over 50% who say, duh, I don't know, there's nothing. When we look at the answers that are given, they kind of split between personality characteristics and issues, but more tilted to the personality. People say it's actually a good thing that he was a business person, that he says what he thinks, says what he feels. We all know he does that, right? That he's confident and wouldn't back down. Those are some of the personality things people say would be a plus for a Trump presidency. Issue-wise, immigration is listed as a plus by a number of people, and then that he would be able to help the economy is also listed.
Now let's go to the worst thing about a Trump presidency.
I would say, looking over the data very carefully, personality, personality, and personality. It's Trump's style, his way of speaking, his outspokenness. That's what people really focus on that would be negative about a Trump presidency, more so than talk about some of his issue positions. Here's some of the words people use when they define it negatively. Say he's too outspoken, he's impulsive, he does not think before he speaks, he is arrogant, he is offensive, rude, and abrupt. He would embarrass the U.S. and lose the respect of other nations. He has a hot temper, he's a bully. All of those are the negatives that people say would be bad about a Trump presidency if he were to be elected. And speaking of a flip, some people say his immigration policies would be a negative as well. So that cuts both ways.
Are voters following this election this January any more or less closely than in January election cycles past?
Voters are actually paying attention to this election. A little too early to know how it's going to compare to where we were in the past, but 31% say they're following things very closely, Dave, 38% somewhat closely. This is not a shock. Young people don't vote, and clearly our data show they're not paying a lot of attention, particularly when we look at that very closely category. If you're listening to this and 65 years in age and older, you're really focusing on the election. 51% following it very closely, and 85% of seniors are following it at least very or somewhat closely. But among young people, 18 to 29, only 22% are following it very closely. So age is a big determinant of your focus on this election.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. And that's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Brett Rader and our intern, Jared Whalen. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Al Banks and Diana Martinez. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a safe weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.